You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by IBEW Local 53 and the Pipefitters Local 533. IBEW Local 53 represents construction linemen, electric, gas, and water utility workers, broadcast engineers at TV stations, line clearance workers, linemen for rural electric cooperatives, employees at rural electric generating stations, and anyone else who's interested. And we sure appreciate those linemen during this time of the year. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. On tonight's show, in the 1950s, St. Louis labor leaders Harold Gibbons and Ernest Callaway championed a new kind of labor movement, embracing workers as total persons, fighting for justice as workers and citizens. The alliance of this interracial duo of Teamsters has profound relevance for today. We'll talk to Robert Bussell about his new book on them. And then, how does community policing work in Kansas City? We will talk to two inspiring cops. In the news, Mexican worker protests on the rise in Ciudad Juarez, and what kind of ethics reform is the Missouri legislature planning anyway? Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news.
And this is the news from our side for January 21st, 2015. Beginning in the summer and fall of 2015, a wave of worker protests over low wages, sexual harassment, and other adverse working conditions broke out in several foreign-owned manufactories, or maquiladoras, in the northern Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez. In a city where genuine union representation in the export plants is practically unknown, the workers' demands for independent unions stood out. The three so-called maquiladoras are Kentucky-based Lexmark, which makes printer cartridges, Eaton Busman, a subsidiary of Cooper Industries, which moved a plant making electrical fuses from North Carolina to Ciudad Juarez in 2012, and the infamous Taiwan-based Foxconn. Workers are under intense repression from the Mexican government to stop the creation of an independent union. In an effort to recruit members to their effort, workers have created a makeshift camp or plantón right outside the Lexmark plant that they have staffed on a 24-hour basis 7 days a week since November 2, 2015. In the week of January 11th, Lexmark workers and their attorney, Susana Prieto Terrazas, traveled to Mexico City and hosted a rally to garner support for their plight. The rally in Mexico City was one of several binational multi-city protests in solidarity with the workers, including a rally near the Lexmark corporate headquarters in Lexington, Kentucky, sponsored by the Kentucky Workers League. In their list of demands, workers want an end to sexual harassment on work lines, the reinstatement of fired workers, and the formation of an independent union. A Lexmark worker told a reporter in Mexico City, "There is a lot of sexual harassment in the industry. The most common one is that the assembly line chiefs and supervisors demand sexual favors for such basic things as overtime hours. The base salary never makes ends meet, and supervisors condition overtime to what the women workers agree to give them." In Juarez, scores of former Lexmark workers burned their old work uniforms outside the Lexmark factory. Miguel Angel Sedano, spokesman for the workers, said, "Lexmark has not approached us to offer a solution. We are going to continue until there is a positive solution. We are starting a boycott and asking the public in general to not buy Lexmark products since his company is violating a lot of the human and labor rights of the workers. Other complaints of the Lexmark workers include unauthorized deductions to their paychecks and exposures to dangerous chemicals in the workplace. The workers have engaged in strikes, and in late December, the Juarez Office of Labor Conciliation and Arbitration Board rejected petitions from Lexmark and Foxconn workers seeking official certification of independent unions. In its decision, the Federal Labor Board cited confusion over the proposed name of a new union and an inadequate financial management plan. The workers vowed that they would appeal the denials of their petitions. Last week, the AFL-CIO issued a strong statement calling on the Mexican government and companies to reinstate the fired workers, stop repression, ensure compliance with the right to form unions, and for the U.S. government to stop any purchases from the plants.
A panel of Missouri lawmakers voted Tuesday to block
a change in state rules that would have given thousands of home care workers raises, and a move that could signal an end to the salary hikes agreed to more than a year ago. Members of the House Government Oversight and Accountability Committee voted 7-1 in favor of stopping the changes sought by Democratic Governor Jay Nixon. State Rep. Jay Barnes, a Jeff City Republican, said the rules changes violated, quote, simple legal requirements, and was not defended by one of Nixon's own agencies during the hearing last spring. Rulemaking is not a willy-nilly anything-goes process, Barnes said. At issue is a dispute over how the governor attempted to implement the raises he and the Missouri Home Care Union agreed to in 2014. The raises would have bumped up the pay scale for people who take care of elderly and disabled from an average of $7.75 per hour to between $8.50 and $10.15 per hour. Lawmakers says the rule changes sought by the governor is flawed and must be rejected. State Rep. Gina Mitten, a St. Louis Democrat, cast a lone no vote. She said these home health care workers have a right to collectively bargain, but the law has stopped them at every avenue. I think what's going on is inappropriate. Nixon earlier said he supports wage increases and believes implementing the increase through the rulemaking process will ensure the provision has full force and effect of law behind it. The legislature is House Concurrent Resolution 59.
Meanwhile, Missouri State Representative Judy Morgan of Kansas City reports to constituents on what she calls ethics reform light. Last week, the House passed four ethics bills. They are HB 1979, which would require future lawmakers to wait at least 1 year from the scheduled end of their terms before taking a job as a lobbyist. However, the bill exempts any lawmaker who leaves office at the end of this year. They could go straight from the legislature to the lobbying corps, thus perpetuating the so-called revolving door at least for the next couple years. Next is HB 1983 on political consulting, which prohibits lawmakers from serving in the legislature while also being political consultants on the side. However, it doesn't apply to the legislative staff, who often wield great influence and make big bucks on the side. HB 1575 provides for disclosure of lodging and travel expenses. Currently, lawmakers are required to report on their annual personal financial disclosure forms any lodging or travel expenses outside the state of Missouri that are paid by a third party, whether it's a gift or in relation to the duties of their office. HB 1575 would require reporting within 30 days of the trip or receipt of the funds for the trip, whichever comes first. HB 1452 provides for the filing of personal financial disclosure reports twice a year instead of once, and in election year, three times. Unfortunately, none of these bills actually curbs the amount of money legislators can accept either while in office or while running for office in campaign donations. Tonight's news was read by Jen Zaman, Michael Savoir, and I'm Molly Madden.
Nine
never taught us any labor history. It's a mystery how we survived. We know all about the captains of industry, but it's the unions that help keep us alive. It's the unions that help keep us alive. Who needs Washington of a cherry tree? He could not tell a lie. But they tell us lies about who does the work and who gets the gravy and why. Forget about the Boston Massacre and that stuff about the tea. Remember the Haymarket Massacre and the fire in the shirtwaist factory. They never taught us any labor history.
And that's Pat Wynn with her new CD. The song's called Labor History. And I'm Judy Ansel. And tonight's show is the first of two in a series we're doing on alternative unionism, what's called alt-labor these days. And this one is going to be a look at labor history. Our guest is Bob Bussell. He's a professor of history and director of the Labor Education and Research Center, or LERC, at the University of Oregon. He's held that post since 2002. Bob has spent over three decades working with the union movement, including 10 years as an organizer with the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union and 20 years as a university-based labor educator. He's published numerous articles on labor history and contemporary labor issues in both academic and popular publications. His first book was called From Harvard to the Ranks of Labor, Powers, Hapgood, and the American Working Class, and it appeared in 1999. Tonight, we're going to talk about his new book called Fighting for Total Person Unionism, Harold Gibbons, Ernest Callaway, and Working Class Citizenship. It was published by the University of Illinois Press in the fall of last year. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Judy.
Well, it's a pleasure, and so is this book. You know, I'd heard about Harold Gibbons as an international Teamster vice president under Jimmy Hoffa. I never realized he was such a creative labor leader because I guess I fell for that old stereotype, you know, of the Teamsters. And I'd never heard of Ernest Callaway and the partnership they had, which brought which was a biracial partnership and had tremendous influence over St. Louis in the 1950s. How'd you get interested in these two guys?
Well, it goes back, Judy, I guess, to the late 1970s. There's a book you may be familiar with, and maybe some of your listeners, that Stephen Brill, who is a labor journalist, wrote. It was called The Teamsters. And so I got this book as a present, and the last chapter was about Harold Gibbons, who I knew nothing about. At the time, as you mentioned, I was working for the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers on a nationwide boycott we were running. So I was doing a lot of labor community work and was really interested in the possibilities that I could see coming out of taking labor struggles and turning them into social, or not really turning them into, but portraying them legitimately as social justice fights. And then I read about Harold Gibbons and some of the work in St. Louis, and the thing that particularly intrigued me was this program they called a community stewards program, that they took the concept of being a shop steward from the factory floor and said, let's treat the community like an employer and have these stewards engage in real community activity, really serving as working class citizens. So I was intrigued by that, and I filed it away, and I went on to be a labor educator, as you mentioned, and to study history, and 20 years later, I thought, well, let me go back and look at this, because I was looking for a topic for a second book, and just to make the long story short, I went to Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. That's where Harold Gibbons' papers are located. I found 90 boxes of material and a lot on this community stewards program, and I said, well, I think I've got a biography here. And then there was one of these happy accidents where the archivist at SIUE said to me, you know, there's a guy named Ernest Callaway. I think he worked with Harold Gibbons, and his papers are across the river at the University of Missouri, so you might want to check that out. And then I stumbled onto this fascinating character, Ernest Callaway, who was a prolific writer, public intellectual, labor leader, head of the NAACP in St. Louis. And I realized that they had really worked together, and Callaway had been the intellectual architect of much of the programming that Gibbons did in the 50s and 60s. So then I decided it had to be a dual biography, and I'm glad that I did it that way, but I will say that it probably took me an extra 5 to 7 years to complete. But that's the genesis of the story.
Well, doing a dual biography is a challenge in itself. I'd say I really like the way you switched back and forth and sort of paralleled these two guys' lives until they come together in the early 50s and actually work together. Give us some background about their early lives, real briefly.
Right. In fact, that was one of the tasks I have when I talk about this. I kind of say I've got to get them to St. Louis fairly quickly. I think the shorthand way to talk about
four.
It is that they had a surprising amount of things in common, even though you would think Gibbons is Irish Catholic, Callaway's African American, America is rigidly segregated at the turn of the 20th century. But I'd say several things about them are really important to understand. One is that they're both coal miners' sons. Gibbons in Pennsylvania, Callaway in Kentucky. And so I think they acquired quite a well-developed sense of class consciousness and appreciation for trade unionism coming out of that experience. They both suffered from extreme poverty. They were also very bright young men, but with limited social prospects as poor working class youth. They find their way to Chicago, and that's in the 1930s, and that's really an important proving ground for them. So some other things, Gibbons gets involved with the Works Progress Administration, WPA, adult education program, and becomes a union activist. And the thing that's interesting to me is they were both very young men, and they rise to real positions of leadership in the union movement. Gibbons is 26 and becomes the national vice president of the American Federation of Teachers, and Callaway becomes involved with the Red Caps Union, and he's their education director and edits their newspaper, Bags and Baggage, and he's in his early 30s by that point as well. They're born a year apart, so they're close in age. They got their education through independent types of schools. Gibbons at the Wisconsin School for Workers, Callaway at the famed Brookwood Labor College just north of New York City. And the other thing is they were both socialists, although not involved officially with the Socialist Party for that long. But I think they really, as I put it, continued to think in a socialist idiom. They were also staunchly anti-communist. They each in different ways had bruising encounters with the Communist Party and were anti-communist, although I think they don't easily fit into some of the labels of anti-communist liberals either. But those were among their formative experiences. I'd say the other thing is certainly Callaway was a staunch fighter for racial justice throughout his life, but Gibbons as well. And so that really became, for both of them, kind of one of their moral barometers of the legitimacy and credibility of the union movement. And again, they were both CIO folks. Mm-hmm. Gibbons, after the AFT, worked with the Textile Workers Organizing Committee, and Callaway's union was a CIO union. So that actually made it pretty interesting when they ended up going to the Teamsters affiliating with the Teamsters in the late 1940s.
You talk about Gibbons's experience working as an organizer for the Textile Workers Organizing Committee and his differences with Sidney Hillman, who was the head of that operation, and his early formation of no faith in government. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because Gibbons, Stephen Brill interviewed him for his book in the late 70s, he said, you know, if you knew the way we were treated back in those days, you'd understand why we had so little faith in government, or that even the outlaw label is one at some level we embrace, because, you know, as you know, I mean, the 1930s, organizing, well, it's been this way historically, but it was a very hostile environment, and for Gibbons, particularly particularly, but Callaway was certainly aware of this stuff as well. There was considerable picket line violence. There were court injunctions. There was collusion between police and political leaders and employers. And it's the type of thing that also was a formative crucible for somebody like Jimmy Hoffa in spades, perhaps, that this sense of just this distrust of quote-unquote established structures, of established structures. In fact, I think in some ways, there was a certain level of almost syndicalism for Gibbons at that time in terms of really wanting to use working-class power as much as possible, and he, retained a certain faith in that throughout his life, and that was, of course, a point of dispute with Hillman, who was more the labor statesman and much more, Gibbons would not necessarily eschew the National Labor Relations Board or those sorts of procedures. But even during World War II, when there was a no-strike pledge, he and his union in St. Louis just openly chafed under those sorts of barriers. And the Teamsters in St. Louis were known for striking to get initial contracts, and they kept that up certainly as much as they could throughout Gibbons' career.
Yeah, well, certainly a huge proponent of direct action.
Yes, absolutely.
And Callaway is interesting. You have an interesting quote. During the period... he was working in Chicago as an organizer and editor of the paper for the Red Caps Union, and Red Caps were porters on the railroads, largely African-American. And you quote him as cautioning African-American unionists to eschew narrow racializing of all important issues and urging them to resist the tendency to think too much about with our skins instead of with our minds. So how does Callaway connect the issues of civil rights and labor?
Right. Well, Callaway was certainly somebody that tried to think about class and race, and not that he necessarily gave them equal bearing, but I think he really very much. I think for Callaway, what he tried to say was, yes, race is a huge barrier, but once we remove some of those legal barriers, there are deeper structural issues that really oppress African Americans. At least that was his perspective. So he would, often argue that, we really need to get at employment, we need to get at housing, we need to get at education, we need to get at the types of economic and political decisions that power elites make that really shape the social and economic infrastructure, particularly of cities. He was really very much interested in the city as an environment. So I think he was really a structuralist and at some level remained, I wouldn't say he was an economic determinist, but he certainly retained that socialist sensibility or idiom in terms of how he thought about things. And that's where he ran into some difficulties as far as the black freedom struggle in St. Louis, because I think at some level there were other elements or forces that said that, race really did matter in very fundamental ways, and that Callaway was perhaps too quick to reject that notion.
Well, yeah, or I guess you could say, he really understood the concept of institutional racism in a period where, he's operating in a segregated society where there were clearly simple, very, very clear racial distinctions made in the law. Talk about their collaboration. Okay, so Gibbons comes to St. Louis first and takes over this warehouse local, which at that point was not part of the Teamsters. He merges it with the Teamsters later on. And then he hires Callaway in 1951, I think it was, to join him to work together. They had briefly met in Chicago. So can you talk about their collaboration and where it took them?
Sure. Let me try to do that as briefly as I can, but give you some sense of the dimensions of that. Because what I think was really interesting, and in a way you can kind of link this up to what's going on now, I think some of the strategic discussions the union movement is having with the reemergence of right to work and this Supreme Court decision that is likely to take away agency fees in the public sector, that after Taft-Hartley passed in 1947, Callaway and Gibbons were very clear, we're not going to have the the protections such as they were that government provided to the union movement. And they said, we really need to start thinking, and then also direct action in some of the ways they had done it. Taft-Hartley barred certain types of collective action, sympathy strikes, secondary boycotts, those sorts of things. So they said that the union movement's got to play much more in the community. And really the foundation for this was this idea that the workers were total persons, as Callaway would sometimes put it. Workers were not just economic, but they were social beings, that you worked 8 hours a day, but you spent the other 16 days of your life living in a community. So you had social and psychological needs, and also no matter how good your conditions were on the shop floor, and they did some amazing things as far as health care and you know, various types of benefits for their members, they would say that no matter how good that is, if you go and live in a community where housing isn't good, education isn't good, the infrastructure isn't good, transportation and all of that, you've only come so far. So they really wanted to use the new power and legitimacy that their union had around the notion of community betterment. And so they created this community steward system. They looked at the city of St. Louis as an employer. They looked at wards in the city almost like departments in a factory. They had community stewards that would solicit grievances in their neighborhoods. They would have regular community meetings annually and decide on issues they would take on. And so they took on things like transportation. They took on things like having a coordinated system to deal with you know, sewers and flooding and drainage in St. Louis, which had real public health dimensions. They fought an amazing campaign on public health around rat control, which affected particularly the African-American community in St. Louis, and were able to get a binding rat control ordinance, and that really helped them win their spurs. They fought for a free city college system. They had programs around juvenile delinquency, around housing. So they did a bunch of really, really interesting things in terms of really trying to improve the social infrastructure of the city of St. Louis in the 1950s, and then beat back an attempt to change the city charter. With Callaway was head of the NAACP at that time, Gibbons is head of the Teamsters. And they beat back an attempt by the elite in the city to go from a ward system to an at-large system, which would have diluted labor and African-American political power. So they really did some pretty amazing things in terms of this concept of total person unionism and creating what they call the community bargaining table. And I think it's a very rich and resonant concept, which not only was meaningful then, but I think has some relevance to us today as well.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that in a minute. But didn't they run into problems with the rest of the labor movement, and particularly the racist aspect of the labor movement?
Well, there were several things about their ability to work with other unions. I mean, in part, their racial progressivism set them against a number of unions in St. Louis. That was one piece of it. They also, on political grounds, had broken with the UE, which was a left union, even communist union, and on political grounds, that was not an alliance that worked that well. They had working relationships with the UAW, I think with the meat cutters and some other unions. There was also a counterpole politically, the steam fitters union, and they were often at loggerheads with them as well. And then particularly after the Teamsters are expelled from the AFL CIO in, I think, 57, and Gibbons, of course, hitches his start at Jimmy Hoffa's, and that's another whole part of the book, his relationship with Hoffa and his work in the National Union. But I think there were some limits to the level of alliances they had within the rest of the labor community. Not that they were pariahs or not that they were totally left out, but there was at least a number of unions that felt as if they tended to go it alone, which at some level they did. So there were some boundaries around the type of labor solidarity or inter-union solidarity that they were able to engage in. On the other hand, I think they had an enormous credibility with the African-American community, which many, many unions certainly did not have at that time.
Okay. We're talking to Robert Bussell, who's written a book called Fighting for Total Person Unionism, Harold Gibbons, Ernest Callaway, and Working Class Citizenship. And we have like 1 minute left, Bob. So let me ask you, it goes quick. Let me ask you, what are the lessons for today? I mean, can you pinpoint one or two?
Yeah, I mean, I think this idea of total person unionism does have some potential legs. This idea that that there are broader issues beyond a shop floor and ways in which becoming a working class citizen, being able to exercise the knowledge and expertise you have as a worker from a shop floor in a community, is important. So I think about these broader fights around minimum wage and paid sick leave, work-family balance. I think some of those things are really critically important lessons that we can get from Gibbons and Callaway. I think that the luxury of some of the infighting in the union movement, I think it circumscribed the fortunes and things that they could do. I think I'm not naive about this, but I think it's the lack of solidarity is a luxury I think we can ill afford. And also just racial justice, the very strong commitment to racial justice is a moral barometer of the union movement's legitimacy. When Rich Trumka came to Missouri and talked about Ferguson and all, that was the type of thing that Gibbons and Callaway would have applauded, right. And I think the union movement would do well to step up in that regard even more than it has. And I guess the final thing I would just say, this notion that you can use the expertise you have as a worker to enhance your life as a citizen, I think is something that is kind of a sensibility as well as a call to action that I think it would behoove us to consider. And I think there are certain unions that really are actually doing some of this and could even exercise it even more effectively.
Well, that'll have to be the last word. Thank you so much, Bob Bussell, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
And oh, it's been a pleasure, Judy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And stay tuned for our interview with two cops who are community police.
We're especially excited today to be able to bring to you a topic of conversation that is critical to our community and critical to the nation at large. Our theme today, moving the money, concrete steps for economic justice for all people.
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the American Friends Service Committee's annual Martin Luther King Day Forum on the Thursday night special tonight at 7.
Man trying to make a living.
Blues, Barbecue, and Brews, a musical evening benefiting All Souls Unitarian Church and KKFI. The performances by Danny Cox and Bob Walkenhorse and the Shawnee Mission East Jazz Band. Saturday, January 30th from 6 to 9 p.m., 4500 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. Doors at 5:30, music at 6, dinner served at 6:15. Donation of $25 includes all the music and all you can eat. For just $20, all the music you can hear. Advance tickets available at All Souls Unitarian Church, 10 to 2, Monday through Friday, or at 816-531-2131. Benefiting KKFI and All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. That's Blues, Barbecue, and Brews on January 30th at 6 p.m. Come on out.
Tonight our show is a rebroadcast of a January 2015 program on community policing.
This is
Michael Savoie.
And tonight we have two police officers, Matt Tomasik and Chato Villalobos, with us from the West Side. These two officers are truly community police officers. And we just want to ask first, how did you get into community policing? Give us a little background.
Well, I've been on the police department 21 years, and the first part of my career was spent on the street and then in narcotics. And after that time, I wanted to do something community-based. So I took a position at the Westside CAN Center. I've been there for the last 12 years.
Okay.
Yeah, myself, it was just a matter of coming home. I grew up on the West Side, and it was just an opportunity. I worked in the Violent Crimes Division for a few years, and I've done patrol and other kind of investigations, but it was a point in my career where I just wanted to change and come back home to the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, you guys have really distinguished yourselves as being the most effective type of policing in our city. So, I mean, your reputation kind of precedes you, man.
Yeah, and we wanted to know, what is community policing and how did you start community policing?
Yeah, we community policing, I mean, the way we define it is just a philosophical approach to policing that has the primary thing that we do is about problem solving and relationships. We have law enforcement as a tool, but that's not our way of being. We've been given a lot of freedom, you know, by our commander, Forte, Chief Forte, who really endorses us to say, get out there, be accessible to these people. We have the luxury of not having to answer calls, 911 calls. The patrol guys, you know, they work their tails off doing that so that we can really get into the schools and know the neighborhood. And so,
and you can stay in one area.
Absolutely. We're assigned to a certain area, and so the longer we're there, the more the relationships develop. And so, you know, that's how we really get to the bottom of a lot of crime down there, is the people that come to us.
Yeah. Could you tell us a story about what was happening under the bridge before you got there?
Well, we had a situation where we'd have, you know, well over 100 guys stand out in front of Royal Liquor and wait for day labor, and that was a result of federal immigration policy, actually. So that was a problem. The West Side, is particularly on a hot days, would smell really bad. Guys were standing out there for 8 to 10 hours and with no place, no restroom for them to use. The businesses didn't want the guys coming in. I understand that. And my initial approach, which took me about a year and a half before I came up with a better idea, the initial approach was to ticket people whenever we saw them urinating public or infractions. And that didn't solve the problem. But what did was, we had a small office about a block away from the liquor store, and we allowed the guys to come in and use the restroom.
Was Linda Callen there then?
Yeah, and it was all Linda's idea.
Yeah.
Linda said, why don't we let them use our restroom, when I was complaining about, you know,
girl,
this isn't getting any better. But what that did was, it did a couple things. One, it allowed the guys to come in and use the restroom. The other thing it did was, I learned the lesson that if I'm giving you a place to use the restroom and you're still choosing to use the street, then you're telling me something about your intent, and then I can focus my efforts on you. And that led to really identifying the people who were problems in the group or troublemakers.
The amazing thing about the whole thing was, before Matt and Linda did that outreach to this, you know, to this group, was I grew up in that neighborhood, and I remember it was like a gauntlet walking through that, because the two bridges that you're talking about where this day labor pool was our access to church, to the Boy Scout meetings. I remember my mother and I and my two sisters walking through this group of men, and you didn't know who was good, what were their intent, and just you reeked like feces and urine. And when I found out about this 6'1" Croatian police officer, went down there and did this type of outreach to the guys, and they were able to know him, and they had a place to use the restroom, and he did this with, you know, it was a form of compassion. To me, coming back to work to this community, I was so proud, because the kids that live there now didn't have to go through what I went through, or the parents didn't have to worry about their kids going to this liquor store to get milk, tortillas, eggs, or whatever it was. That was our grocery store. And it wasn't until Matt, you know, finally went to Linda, and Linda kind of, I'll be happy to say it, I know he agrees with me, she taught us how to be cops.
Okay.
Yeah, so a little mutual respect and consideration.
Absolutely.
Works both ways, does it not?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of kids, could you talk about your work with the kids? Are you like officer friendly? Or
yeah, I'm officer friendly, officer big brother, officer, you know, surrogate father. We're very lucky to have a great relationship with the schools in our neighborhoods. There's two elementary schools, a middle school and a high school, that sit within the boundaries of the West Side. And Alta Vista, which is a school chartered through the Guadalupe Center, is one that I'm most closest to. Their middle school and high school kids, the principals, the teachers always have me come down and talk to these kids. And the approach is that if they're starting to, you know, make bad choices or whatever, I get to come in and pull them out and say, hey, what's going on, man? Well, let me tell you about my story. I grew up on the West Side, and my parents were immigrants, and I remember being frustrated with, you know, the language thing. Being my first language was Spanish, and so I remember struggling. I'm like, but look what you can do, you know, if you focus, if you refocus and put your mind to it, you could be just like me. I'm no different than you. You know, I grew up in poverty, single parent home, and they think that by that relationship, then I get to check up on them too. And so it's a really fascinating dynamic, and it goes to what. Now what happens is we've been there 8 years together. We get these kids are 23, 21 years old that come up to us now like, hey, I got this job. We just want to come back and say thank you guys. You guys were there for us. You guys gave us good advice. Can we be cops? And I think it's just wonderful. I mean, it's just
– I think one of the things that we're most proud of is that we've had four kids that that we mentored when they were younger have come to us and said, I want to be a policeman. One kid this summer, it was about 103 degrees out. He came in, and he'd been roofing. And he said,
I'd want to be a policeman.
He said, I was on that roof, and I remember that class I took that you guys taught about the city government, and I want to be a policeman.
Matt has even had guys that used to be involved in criminal activity come up to him later and says, hey, look what I'm doing now. Can you help me put a resume together? And there's no better testimony than that, you know?
Right. And I heard a story about you do camps, summer camps,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, it's camping.
And, and somebody was shaving?
Yeah, that's Matt's story. Linda was real huge about getting the kids outside of their norms, and so we did a camp in the park, and I'll let him talk about the details of that.
So we spend the night up at Observation Park, and we have kids. And for this camp out, it's particularly kids from the West Bluff Housing Project take advantage of it. And I don't know why, but that's mostly the kids. That's where they come from for this camp out. Mm-hmm. And on the first camp out, Linda told me, Matt, listen, I don't want you to shave for about a week because I want you to give a shaving demonstration. And
but your wife wasn't too happy.
Well, you know, I thought, that's dumb. I didn't say that. But not to her face, but I thought that. But anyway, I followed along. And so the Saturday came, and we gave the kids popsicle sticks and shaving cream, and I had a razor, and the kids, you know, lathered up their face. But you would have thought I was splitting an atom the way these kids were gathered around me, every kid in the place just concentrating on me. And it occurred to me that they're going to have to shave in their life, and they've never seen anyone shave, or if they have, not often. Mm-hmm. Whereas I could have watched my dad shave every morning if I wanted to, but they don't have a father in their lives.
Yeah, it was a real powerful moment for just to have that realization that, you know, things we take for granted and how they look to us, like you were our male figure in our community, and mm-hmm. sometimes we were all they had, and so that's real, you know, got lucky.
Do they take day trips, like, to the zoo and things like that?
Yeah, you know, we're a not-for-profit agency, you know, the agency that we are partnered mm-hmm. up with. But there's a lot of resources within the community. We get to tag along. You know, we have great relationships with the Guadalupe Center or Amati Rhodes. And mm-hmm. whenever they have stuff or the schools, they're like, hey, if you guys are around, can you guys come with us? And if we can, we totally jump at those opportunities, you know. So we don't, but we do have like a back-to-school drive where we raise a lot of money and gather a lot of school supplies to hand out backpacks to kids in the neighborhood.
So uniforms, we'll
do,
maybe, too?
You know, we don't do uniforms, but we do try to just whatever initiative that we can do to be a part of, because we don't have a budget, a working budget. Okay. The only thing the police department pays for us is just our salaries and our equipment. So what we do is the relationships. There are pre-existing not-for-profit agencies that do have those kind of youth services. And we're present, so we're accessible. The after-school stuff, the during-school stuff, the summer programs. So we do get to just jump in there and pick and choose wherever the need is. We just make ourselves accessible. We try not to reinvent the wheel.
Oh, and get them young.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And one of the things that we help facilitate is our community garden. And I think that is very important because you have older people interacting with younger people. And there's an exchange of ideas. There's an exchange of learning. The kids get to see where food comes from. We have some chickens, so they get to see, to some degree, the life cycle. And it's a very powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I heard of schools having gardens, but
yeah,
not chickens.
Yeah.
Well, all I can say is that I wish that I would have had this kind of experience when I was coming up.
Yeah.
It was police were not by my design the adversary, but it just seemed to always work that way. And, you know, it makes me realize that love is the greatest motivator on the planet. And when you've got that love relationship, then everything works so much better.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we heard about a NOVA project. Could you?
Yeah, that's the chief's initiative, the No Violence Alliance. And that's one of the things that really took our work to another level was the NOVA is like basically they take all the stats and they try to see who are the really active criminals in certain communities, who are the ones affecting the quality of life, and what is their level of influence. And instead of being an occupying force, the philosophy is we're going to do target-oriented policing, find these guys. And what they do, they go after these guys. It's not to put them in jail. It's like, we're going to have a meeting with you. We're going to tell you how serious we are about improving the quality of life in these neighborhoods. We're tired of having the homicide rates of these young people's lives being taken for no good reason, you know. And what they do is they try to plug these guys into these, you know, programs. And we talk about all the things that affect, you know, systemic issues that we have. And, you know, with lack of education, poverty, mental health, health care, all these things that these people are experiencing. And, you know, I mean, the school district, you know, they're, God bless them, they're trying, but, you know, the accreditation issues. So what is the common denominator that affects? So they try to address and say, we're going to plug you in. We're going to help you either find a job or get this service that you need or whatever it is. But, you know, letting you continue to continue a life of crime is not an option. And so the people that take them up on it, it's great. It's life-changing, and they have a level of influence in their communities. But the ones that don't, then we know. It's kind of like the, you know, the comparison to what Matt did with those guys. I'm giving you a place to use the restroom. These mm-hmm. people in this community are tired of walking with their kids under these bridges. And if you choose not to use the restroom and still do that, then I know who to go after instead of coming down and, you know, addressing the whole group when, you know, we know who's doing this stuff. So what happened
In the first year, NOVA's there, we have 23% homicides. We have 23% less homicides than we had last year, and that is huge.
And that's how it's helped us is that they've hosted these meetings and they've picked our neighborhood and says, hey, we got these names, we pulled all these reports, we did the research, we know, and then through information that the community gives themselves, they're like, hey, this guy here is, you know, we think maybe if you guys got a hold of them. So they get invited to this meeting, they get the same presentation. We're going to give you a chance to walk away from this life of crime, and we're going to help you. You need to get your GED, whatever it is. And there was actually some very influential kids. I mean, they're young guys, mm-hmm. 18, 19, 20 years old, that were really on the path to either death or prison or killing other people. And they took them up on it, and it's just a dramatic change. And you see the people that they had an influence around really start backing away from this lifestyle. And so even on the west side, we see the level of shootings has gone down and stuff. And there has been the sweeps of the people, you know, who maybe didn't take them up on it. And, you know, those people that got arrested.
Does this work where there's not community policing, where there's just patrols?
Community policing is a philosophical approach. And there's a lot of officers in uniform that actually do that they try to be proactive and make themselves accessible and create relationships in the community. Unfortunately, 911, I mean, we're low staff out there. We get the freedom that we don't answer calls for service. We focus strictly on the relationships and being accessible, whereas these cops got to answer 911 calls. And
so they really don't have time.
They don't. And I would, but a lot of them try to be. You know, they try to do the follow-ups when somebody's got broken into. They try to find the patriarch or matriarch in the community. They try to form relationships with their community-based organizations. And there's a lot of efforts out there. It's just, you know, we're caught between low manpower and calls for services are up, 911 calls, and do we have the time to take two officers out of the field and let them do what they do? But, you know, this
chief... Is there a way to implement?
This chief really endorses it. So this chief really has gone down the chain of commands, has gotten his captains, his commanders to say, hey, we need to have relationships. We can't do this on our own. The people will tell us what we need to do. We work for the people. And he's from the community, you know, and this guy gets it.
And truly, truly, relationships solve crimes.
Absolutely.
And crime cannot thrive in an area where people have relationships with the police department.
But they don't have time to have relationships because they're giving out tickets. You know?
Well, you know, from my perspective, Molly, I bet we're not very far away since this model has been so successful. I bet it wouldn't take a whole lot of push for the various neighborhood associations to request and perhaps be funded to have a similar style of policing available, at least to some extent in those communities
they
as
need,
well.
They need money.
Yeah. Some of the programs that get funded by outside sources like PAL and GREAT and DARE, you know, we have a few initiatives on this police department that I'm real proud of. They really focus on the relationships with the young people or with the communities. But, yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a movement. If they see the success, I think this is a chief to get us there.
You know, and I bet there's even opportunities for the individual neighborhoods to raise monies towards such a program. You know, with a little initiative.
How about poor
neighborhoods? It takes allies. Yeah. It definitely takes allies for us to.
Yeah, you're building relationships. You're building community.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe Kaufman could kick in.
Hope he's listening.
You know, yeah.
Well, Kansas City is lucky to have a lot of supporters like Kaufman, Hallmark, and people that really support community-based initiatives. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okay. Well, it looks like the next people are up, so thank you. Oh.
We've got three more minutes.
Three more minutes, okay. Now, I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, I don't remember what you were going to say, but what I'll say is, you know, I'm certainly optimistic that this model of policing can permeate our community because I see the success that you guys are having, and I think everyone else does, and certainly I recently read some statistics that actually really made me have a warm feeling about your chief, man. This guy's doing a great job.
Yeah, these things don't happen. I mean, I think a lot of police departments, that's probably one of their main issues or challenges is, like, does the department buy into the whole thing? Or you have your officers, do you identify the talent of those that really want to do it? There's really good detectives, really good dog handlers. We have a lot of talent as police department that could be really good community police officers. And this department, one of the things I know they identified was a commander that actually goes out there and does that talent search, say, mm-hmm. Are we using our best resources, you know, And so I can't speak enough about this. I didn't hate cops as a kid, but I was scared of them. Uh-huh. And I can't tell you, you know, when I came onto this police department, how far we came along. And I think the command staff has a lot to do with it. You know, specifically the Chief Forte.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And the last question is recruitment of people of color up.
It's a top priority for this chief. Absolutely. Uh-huh. And that's where it goes. Well, absolutely, and it takes having positive relationships, like the things that we do, a lot of things that some of the officers are doing out there. You have good relationships with the police department. Well, then the community people are going to look at this as an honorable job instead of being scared by what you see on the media.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
thank you.
This is Angie Williams, here tonight from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I thought I'd talk a little bit about something that I've been getting a lot of phone calls at my office, and that is the subject of immigration raids. Right before the new year, the Obama administration announced that they would be conducting raids on cases of recent arrivals who had finished their court cases. Now, I've been getting tons of calls at my office of people worried about whether or not this applies to them. I can give some general advice on who this is supposedly does qualify for and doesn't qualify for. I say general because it can apply to pretty much anybody, but the ones that they are supposedly targeting, particularly with these raids, are people that arrived after January 2014 and people who have finished their immigration case. That means someone who has already had their trial or missed their court date and got a final order of removal or had their trial and lost and appealed and has lost and now has the final order of removal and is finished with everything. These are the people that they are supposedly targeting. That means that if you don't have a case right now at all, or if you currently are in removal proceedings with an active case pending, these cases probably aren't about you, or these raids probably are not focused on you. Now, that being said, that doesn't necessarily mean you may not at some point find an ICE officer knocking on your door. So I thought I'd go over a couple things to help people know what your rights are in case ICE, and that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, does show up at your house, knocking on their door, asking if they can come inside. First of all, you do not have to open the door. ICE cannot come in your house without a warrant unless you let them in. This is actually true of any police. They cannot come into your house unless they have a warrant signed by the judge, unless you invite them in. And I tell you one thing, if they are knocking on your door and asking for permission, it means they do not have a warrant. You have the right to tell them that they cannot come in your house. Now, if they have a warrant, they're going to already be inside your living room. Once you let them in your house, then they have the right to ask anybody that's in the house for identification and what their legal status is. That puts everybody in the house at risk. It's my advice to not open the door at all. If they're asking and knocking on the door and saying, "This is ICE, we're looking for so-and-so," if that person isn't there, say, "We're not going to open the door. Do you have a warrant?" You can't come in unless you do have a warrant. If you encounter ICE anywhere outside of your house, or if you do happen to get arrested by ICE, you have the right to remain silent. Again, this is something that applies to any contact with the police. You always have the right to remain silent, and I highly recommend that you use that right to remain silent. Pretty much the only thing that you should probably be telling the police in any arrest type situation is your name and your address and your birth date. That's pretty much it. Anything else might put you at risk of divulging information about you that could later be used against you in this case, an immigration court, but if it's in any other type of police situation, in a regular court of law against you. You have the right to say, "I plead the Fifth Amendment and I choose to remain silent," or "I don't want to answer any questions unless I have a lawyer here with me." You absolutely have a right to say that. The third thing is, do not sign anything. If ICE gives you anything to sign, don't sign it if you don't understand it. Don't sign it if it's not in your native language. Don't sign it if it's not been translated. And don't sign it unless you're absolutely certain that it's not something saying that you agree to be removed back to your country. If it's something that just says that you acknowledge that you received a piece of paper, that may be okay, but you have the right to say you don't want to sign anything without talking to a lawyer first. Again, that's something that's probably a good idea when you encounter any kind of law enforcement agent. Anytime that you ask for the right to talk to your lawyer, you are protecting your rights. Finally, in terms of ICE, please report the raids. Take pictures, videos, notes, badge numbers, numbers of agent, and write down exactly what happens. If you do get arrested, talk to an attorney, call your family, have them talk to an attorney, get representation immediately. That is extremely important if you ever get arrested by immigration, or in fact, if you ever get arrested by the police. It is extremely important to get legal help as soon as possible. That's all the time we have for tonight. Again, this is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams, here with Know Your Rights. You can find me on the web at www.williamslawkc.com. Thanks, and be safe.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for January 21st, 2016. Kickoff for campaign to save the KC earnings tax, Monday, January 25th, 10:30 a.m. And that will be at the Chamber of Commerce Boardroom in the lobby of Union Station. Rally against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Tuesday, February 2nd, 9 a.m., Federal Building, 12th and Cherry, downtown. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Tuesday, February 2nd, 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut.
And you can find our calendar at our webpage, heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be called An Interview with Visionary Organizer Jane McAlevey. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.